Hands up, Muppets. In honor of the Happy Time Murders, what's the best on-screen puppet?
I'm Katie Richard. I'm going with Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors because feed me, Seymour.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I'm going with the New Line Henson-made Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which were puppets on top of actors' heads.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I don't know. I kind of just want to go with Yoda, which seems...
I assumed Dave would do Yoda.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just thinking about how much I love the fact that they went back to puppet Yoda for The Last Jedi. Yep. And how much personality that little puppet has. I may not be a ride or die Star Wars guy, but it's hard to deny
Yoda.
The power just of puppetry Yoda. That Yoda exudes.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 226, and it's the week of Wednesday, August 22nd. On that day in 1986, usually the end of August is a dead, horrible time for movies. But on this week in 1986, Stand By Me was released. It's a good
Yay.
One.
Yay!
I feel like we need to go back to that time in life.
Will Wheaton.
We don't have Matt Patches this week, and we don't have any reviews, so it's time to badger you all.
But I was going to say, we also don't know where Matt Patches is. We could be listening back to this, learning that he has died.
Regretting our flippant attitude.
Right.
This is like when we said we do review episodes after Hillary was president, thinking that was a thing on our schedule, not an ultimatum.
Or it could be that he just passed out with his baby on his lap. In which case...
He moved. We give him some leeway there.
If afterwards I go online and he's online playing Mario Tennis Aces, I will... We can all fire him together.
No Mario priest. Tennis for the rest of the night if he is still alive, which he may or may not be.
So if you want Matt Patches to live until next week's episode, why don't you leave us a review? Give him something to pull him back from wherever he's gone.
All the reviews are going to be like, great episode, no Patches.
Fine.
Then he won't come back. All right. So we're a little bit behind in that Black Klansman. Spike Lee's new movie has been open across the U.S. For a little over a week now. I managed to see it in my North Carolina Hamlet. Actually a major city in which it was playing in multiple theaters. And as I tweeted, I saw it with a bunch of incoming Duke freshmen who were more respectable of the whole thing than I expected. Anyway, it's not about me. It's about Spike Lee. It is a movie based on a true story with some significant embellishments, which we can get into, about a black cop in Colorado Springs, Colorado in the 70s who infiltrated a local chapter of the KKK and wound up being phone friends with David Duke in the process. And it is a caper and really entertaining in a way that a lot of Spike Lee movies can be, and then it gets really angry and I don't want to say preaching, but it gets very pointed in the message it wants to get across in the way that a lot of Spike Lee can be as well. And I, having seen Old Boy and then not Chirac, but another kind of mediocre one before then, I was kind of like a lot of people, kind of wondering what Spike Lee was going to give us next, and was really entertained by Black Klansman while also being angered and upset by it, which I think I did exactly what he wanted me to do as an audience member. And one of the great things about Spike Lee is that you can kind of see him pulling the strings and enjoy the process of it. And I feel like I went right along with every beat of it. And I'm not the only one, because Black Klansman has been doing really well, but I truly don't really know what either of you guys thinks about it. David, I assume you saw this at Cannes, so you've been sitting with it for a while.
You assume correctly.
Remind me what you think of Black Klansman then, because I guess I knew at some point.
What did I think of Black Klansman? A lot. I was generally...
There's
a lot to think. And, you know, that comes to the qualification that I have not seen the movie since May, which maybe for normal people is not that long ago, but I've had to see and review about 100 movies since then. So it's...
including The Meg.
No, I did not have to see The Meg, actually. But I did have to see Slender Man. Actually, Dave also saw Slender Man, so I can't...
Yeah, and I saw The Meg.
Yeah, but both you didn't have to see...
It's a bad time to be a Dave, is the point.
Yeah, but Dave didn't have to see Mile 22. So that was truly scrambled my brain like nothing else has. I enjoyed BlacKkKlansman very much. I thought it was... and we can get into some of the ways that it may misrepresent the story and pull lessons from it that others might not see. I'm leaving it up to Dave to cite Boots Riley's criticism of the film from over this weekend. I think that for a lot of the movie, not the first couple minutes, it's like, you know, straight down the middle of the barrel with Spike Lee, and certainly it ends that way as well. But for a lot of the middle of the movie, there is sort of an anonymity to the filmmaking where it was interesting. And then there was a split second there where I forgot it was Spike Lee entirely when its focus shifts, or at least is shared by Adam Driver's character, who's playing a secular Jew who goes undercover. He is the body versus Ron Stallworth's voice in, you know, trying to sneak into the KKK. And he is a non-practicing Jew who has never really thought much about his identity. And that took me by surprise because I had no idea that any of that was coming when I sat down to see the movie. And I don't want to boil this down to just how I related to it in some level, but a couple months after the fact, that is what has stayed with me.
You're talking about specifically the scenes where he's being confronted and accused of being Jewish by the members of the Klan?
Yeah, I had never, not never, but there are very, very few movies that grapple with being a white-looking, white-passing, or just straight-up white, white-skinned is probably the easiest way of putting it, Jewish American in movies. That the complexities involved in that identity and its invisibility and the responsibilities and privileges and downsides and so on that come with it. And I don't want to give the movie too much credit for giving any lip service to it, but there are, you can count on one hand the number of movies that have grappled with this. It's like School Ties, BlacKkKlansman, and that's it. I mean, there's a movie like A Serious Man is more about... It goes a little bit deeper into the soul of being Jewish, but it does not negotiate as directly with being the pluralistic element of being Jewish and American, or Jewish and white. And I think it's just part of, and I'm not saying this is a movie primarily about that character or about any of the sort of Jewish American things that it pulls out of there. It's BlacKkKlansman for a reason. I do think that it does speak to a greater focus on pluralism in being something and American, and in a way.
Or, I mean, I would argue that it gets into pluralism of being black and a cop, which is a different kind of identity than American or race, but yeah.
That is a very, very good segue into what the movie is really doing for most of its running time, as much as Adam Driver becomes a key part of the story. I mean, I do think that Katie, everything about the movie does eventually come back to what you were just saying, not just being black. And that is what it is. I found it entertaining. I found it more powerful as it went on. I think that the climactic scenes, especially the ones that aren't super tied up with the busyness of bombs and things of that nature, but like the duality involved in putting Ron Stallworth in the same room with David Duke and Adam Driver's character, and him essentially like playing himself, not Adam Driver, I'm talking about like Ron Stallworth at a certain point, the body of Ron Stallworth introducing himself to David Duke in that scene. I mean, there are so many different levels of code switching and negotiation going on.
And then intercutting with the meeting of the black student group with an activist played by Harry Belafonte in this pretty incredible casting that I didn't know was coming, who's not playing himself, obviously, but a civil rights leader who would have been in his 90s and the 70s anyway.
Right. And I think that, you know, the movie, we are not living in subtle times, and Spike Lee is not a particularly subtle filmmaker. And I think that there is something about that worked for me anyway, about the broad as a barnside approach he takes to this from the word go to, of course, the end. And
well, I think when you get to the end, Dave, I wanted you to talk soon. Sorry, and I interrupted you, David. But when you get to the end and you see the footage from Charlottesville and David Duke himself shows up in the footage from Charlottesville, you're like, this can't be anything but broad because it's so ridiculous that we're in a culture in which David Duke is being allowed to participate and be complimented by the president and all these things. Saying we don't live in subtle times, and it seems like the broadness and kind of the unsettledness of Spike Lee's filmmaking is never more perfect than it is for now, and specifically the Trump administration. And even though the amount of times you hear people say making America great or someone's going to make America great, it's like it kind of clangs. But what else can you do, man?
Yeah, but it's also just so sad for Topher Grace that he was born to play David Duke in a movie.
Oh my God, he's so good in this.
Dave, you read the book.
You read the book or did you only read Crazy Rich Asians?
I did not read the book. I just read Crazy Rich Asians.
Fuck, yeah.
But I didn't see the movie.
Episode, you'll understand the point of this confusion. Stay tuned for the next segment. Sorry, Dave.
This is the memento of fighting in the war room.
But I will have the argument that David said I should cite, and that I definitely should, is that Boots Riley tweeted like a multi-page response that was basically accusing this movie of shirking its responsibility of portraying the reality of how cops infiltrate usually black groups, in this case a black student union and then the KKK, but usually it's more centered on the disrupting the black student union side, and that the movie kind of fails to deal with that. And it also brings up some consulting that Spike Lee did for the New York Police Department, all of which are interesting points, which I would just say just artistically the things that I agree with the Boots Riley thing and my feelings coming out of this movie is this is a good movie that is important for people to see if they don't have a base idea of this knowledge. If you do know things about this time period, say this time period in Colorado and the Ku Klux Klan, or have read the book, or know something about the, you know, black power movements of the early 70s, then a lot of this is going to play so broad to you that it might seem kind of insulting. Because
are you saying that if you're Boots Riley and very knowledgeable, or like you felt like it was repeating things you knew?
I mean, I definitely think it was repeating things that I knew. I didn't know necessarily. I don't want to say it's not a movie for black people or minorities, because I don't think that's true. But that was sort of like my knee-jerk reaction. Like, this is a movie for mainstream white people to look at the Klan and racism still existing. And then he lays out how David Duke's plan was to get somebody in politics and ideally the president of the United States. And it's like a little laugh line in the movie. And this whole movie is based around nesting that idea, which would have been great. And it would have been like the greatest, you know, black movie that had that message I would have seen this year if I hadn't already seen Sorry to Bother You, which is why the Boots Riley tweet and critique is so interesting, is because that's like a super socialist message that's also a black about the disrupting of black and union movements, but doesn't have to be about some for real shit for real, or posing as like this white or this real story about this, you know, Jewish undercover cop who realizes, you know, that, you know, passing white people are just like, you know, black people and discriminated under the Klan. Which, like I said, it's all a good movie and it's executed really well, but it's more like a parable to me than like a drama. So when it does go off and do the crime things with Adam Driver actually undercover, or the middle part of the movie where they're investigating the Klan bomb plot, that I really like. That seems like a really tense, like Spike Lee makes a historical fiction thing and blows it out just enough that it's like a Spike Lee sort of attitude. I think he goes a little bit too far on some of the bookending parts of these movies. Not that the monologues we see aren't powerful, but in the ways that they're shot and montaged, it's beating a mainstream audience that has never thought about this before with the conclusion that it's supposed to come to. Which is what
you
it
don't,
is.
I mean, you don't feel like that's been a hallmark of a lot of what Spike Lee has made, though? Like that you know, that he is repeating his point over and over again, and it might feel obvious to you, but that is what he wants to do. So not that he's necessarily aiming for a mainstream audience, but that's just how he's telling his story.
I mean, maybe, but it's always... Not since, like, the very early Spike Lee movies has it felt like this pointedly at white people about black people.
Hmm.
Like, it's like some of his documentary work and, like, obviously Old Boy and Inside Man are, like, sort of outliers and not having that much to say about it. But it involves everybody in the conversation, I think gets everybody to the point. There's stuff like Do the Right Thing, which is pulling back a slice of life to people that aren't going to see that, and that, you know, also gets to drive home a message. But I don't think that this feels more like that to me, which doesn't feel like a seasoned filmmaker necessarily. It says a lot to me that he doesn't wait to go back to his, you know, trademark people on a dolly thing until one of the last shots of the movie, where it's like, this is the end of the Spike Lee-ness of the movie. The rest is historical montage. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. There's times when this movie steps out of its plot to sort of like do lectures. And unlike other previous times, maybe because I'm aged or maybe because, you know, these issues have always enraged me, so I've done my bit to learn about it. It felt a little bit pandering to me. I think it's a really great movie for a lot of people to see, and I wish I had seen it when I was 17. But that's, I don't know, if anything fell short for me, it was that, especially when there is something like Sorry to Bother You, which I feel like doesn't pull its punches and maybe reaped some of the box office burden because of that, because it was so weird, but with its statement. I tend to give movies more credit if they fall on their face trying something.
I think that Black Klansman was, I don't want to say it was made for white people, but I certainly think that it was meant to make sure that a single white person in its audience would not miss what it was trying to say. And Spike Lee was very conscious of that. And I think it's probably telling that at least a few months later, the first thing that came to mind for me anyway, a white person, in case you haven't been able to tell, was talking about the film's approach of Jewishness, although that it's important to me, and it's something that I have been thinking about a lot in recent years. Particularly, there's a line that Adam Driver's character says about how he never thought about being Jewish, and then ever since the KKK started, he started working with the KKK and hearing all this anti-Semitic rhetoric and understanding the physical threat that comes with it, it's something that he thinks about all the time. And I would be lying if I said that since Trump became president, I've probably thought more about being Jewish and what it means to pass as Jewish and what it means to negotiate between being Jewish and white more than I have in the last 2 years than I had in the 31 years preceding that. So I appreciate the movie on those grounds, and it is it may speak to the idea that Sorry to Bother You was more targeting the audience that it was representing on screen, whereas Black Klansman was going for a broader array of topics or a broader array of viewers, to its detriment, perhaps. I don't know, but it's something that I'm looking forward to seeing again and becoming a little bit more informed about the source material. I don't know how much of an impact it's going to have on me and my ultimate takeaway from the movie, because I think that even if the movie does take a lot of liberties with the truth, it can still spark a lot of interesting ideas. Although I think I just read Boots Riley's screed the once, but raises some really interesting ideas. As the movie is sort of a recruitment film for people and trying to change the perception of black cops and or black people to become cops and so on.
I don't know if the movie is a recruitment film for cops. Like, I think Spike Lee clearly has a different attitude about cops than Bruce Riley does. But I yes. think that history is really valuable to know, and knowing the extent to which, you know, like, I think in the movie they talk about J. Edgar Hoover spiking the Black Panthers, didn't they? Like, about how the FBI called the Black Panthers the greatest threat to the, I'm trying to remember if I'd seen that there or elsewhere. So they recognize some of that history. Like, I, again, as like a white person, who cares what I think about the way that black radical history is depicted, but I feel like it nods to that enough while wanting to stay within the story that it's telling, and a story that is sympathetic to a cop, and a cop who I think is depicted as with a complicated attitude toward the institution that he works for. Like, they've got this kind of cartoonishly racist cop who's he's contrasted with. So, like, obviously he's the bad guy and John David Washington, Adam Driver are the good guys, but I think he is aware that his identity as a black man and a cop can be in conflict with each other, but he has always wanted to be a cop. He does want to be part of this world. And I think that's interesting for this character in a way that if it had gotten more into the specific actual history, the way that Boots Riley was describing it, it would have been a different story and it could have been a better story, but I don't know. It doesn't bother me as much as it bothers Boots Riley, and who cares? But that's when I think about the movie I saw, I feel like I value what Spike Lee did with the history and how he changed it.
Right. I was trying to voice like something that I would definitely felt after I saw the movie, but I will say, having lived through like politically incendiary movies about the sitting president, this one feels dangerous. Fahrenheit 9/11 felt very boring.
I have a sickening feeling that, I think I was going for sinking feeling, it's late, that Fahrenheit 11/9 is only going to feel more boring. I think that
maybe I could skip that one.
Well, there's a way one day, not so far in the future, we can sort of take a step back and unpack the various approaches that filmmakers have taken to try to rile people up about what's happening in the world right now, and maybe look at why Michael Moore's approach, his folksy everyman, like semi-sarcastic approach, isn't really as effective as the anger that Spike Lee brings to the table. I mean, it's a different kind of anger anyway, but I don't know. We'll see how that movie turns out, but I think that, yeah, they're going to make it for an interesting contrast, and then they'll both make for an interesting contrast to Sorry to Bother You.
I think we should also get a Avengers Infinity War edit that ends with Trump saying that Thanos was right. Just like, there are good people on both sides. There were just twice as many people as there needed to be.
Too many, there were too many.
Or to the old and to the new, we rededicate this song to you. Fuck a
silver lining. In the continuing adventures of Dave Saw the Movie, Dave saw Crazy Rich Asians, as did David, and I did not. So I'm going to let you guys talk about it, because in addition to not being Asian, I didn't see the movie and have nothing to contribute to this conversation.
I saw the movie and read the book, and I'm happy. I'm happy to report that the movie, I think, is a more pleasant experience, although I think the book might be more educational to if you're looking for a cultural experience over like just a good time with the movies.
Yeah, I don't know if education is the movie's top priority.
No, definitely not. This is John Chu of Step Up fame, making like a dance movie out of rich people culture.
Oh, I thought we were talking about Blacklist. Whoops. Carry on, pivot. Keep this in, let's go.
In terms of the book first movie thing, I think that what they've really done is they've beefed up Michelle Yeoh's character, Eleanor Young, the mother of the male romantic lead, and her sort of conflict with Constant Wu's Rachel Chu, who is the girlfriend who is a NYU professor that doesn't realize that her boyfriend is a crazy rich Asian. So for those of you that have absolutely no idea what that is, non-mainland Chinese went and settled different parts of South Asia and became like real estate and development and plastics moguls. And they have this whole other sort of society that's part tradition, but then also very lavish. And our romantic comedy is set against the backdrop of this wedding, where we have to figure out if Rachel can handle Nick's family and maybe something about the dudes. As like in the book, the dudes are mostly forgettable in this movie. And I think that the conflict between the two women, because the book is the first in a trilogy, sort of is kind of left hanging, and the movie is forced to have a conclusion, so it could be a happy romantic comedy. And I'm
although
so,
at this point, it does seem like there'll be a sequel, given how much money it made,
which
so.
Is great.
I guess they left something.
But I'm so happy
movie,
with how
the
they...
The movie is, like, submarined at times. It's made... It's like, no, they cut off their nose despite their face sometimes. There's a few subplots in here that I think make the movie less successful in and of itself, but are laying the groundwork for the trilogy.
Oh yeah, I don't disagree with that for sure. Anything that's not based on our main couple, I kind of didn't care so much about. And I think that even though Awkwafina is great as Peaklin, Rachel's friend that they went to Stanford together, we spend like way too much time with Peaklin's family for like funny side business. When really it's, I think these two actresses, I think it's like, I think Rachel might even be slightly overwritten because of how well Constance is able to just actually play her. Constance, we're friends now. Constance Wu is able is able to portray her in the film, and yeah, Michelle Yeoh is just badass all around. I really liked it. I really liked seeing this movie on like a afternoon, like right after getting off work. It like makes you hungry.
That's what I saw.
It makes you forget your day. It's like a perfect, you know, like go remember how your mother and sisters all, you know, contributed to your family lineage sort of movie. Also, also happy romantic comedy.
I am trying to remember all the different times that I cried in this movie. In my old age, I realized that
I now watch
all movies as though I'm on an airplane. It's a strange thing. I think it was really like having a few emotionally pivotal experiences in my like 20s and early 30s. Death, marriage, all those things that made me like a much more sentimental human being, or like I just feel it more intensely. I don't know.
And you don't even have kids yet, and then you're.
I don't. It's only going to get worse from here. or at least like. I don't know.
I watch Coco almost every morning and cry almost every morning. It gets,
it's not like
getting around it.
I don't think Coco. It's necessarily that sort of crying, but I definitely also started crying like when the wedding starts in earnest. It's well, like that sort of movie, like.
Yeah, I got very, that was when I first got really emotional in this movie because, and actually this is not a credit to the movie, a movie that I liked quite a bit. I first got emotional in this movie thinking about my own wedding. And I was like sitting there with my wife and just thinking about our song choices, which are so vastly superior to the ones that in pretty much every movie wedding. Obviously just because they were for us and were for us and so on. But, so I spent most of that scene thinking about my wedding and then was pulled out of my own reverie thinking about the ridiculousness of the wedding in this movie, which is not at the climax. It's not like a wedding between the main characters. This is not a spoiler. This is a, like, she goes to Singapore for a wedding. Dave, I don't know if your audience thought the wedding was as funny as mine did, but my audience was just cracking up at all the accoutrements of the wedding ceremony, in particular the flooded aisle. Which I swear in one shot when they like very briefly cut back to it is like at knee length at one point, as though they are all going to drown in the aisle. It was very confusing.
Well, I mean, in terms of maybe this is the difference between you coastal elites and us normal people, but there was odd gasping when the aisle started flooding. So I guess different strokes or different folks.
Listen, I love a good romantic comedy. This is a very good romantic comedy. I think that it's very smart about all the cultural baggage that it brings into the equation, a lot of which I am not qualified to speak to, but can recognize from a distance anyway. But it also makes a lot of that stuff accessible to a non-Asian audience, certainly a non-Asian audience. But it's all very smart in how it does that, and I think all of it really, because, I mean, Constance Wu is a very expressive actress who does a world of good with not a particularly interesting character. I mean, she's interesting for what she represents and the various dynamics she shares with people, but, like, isn't maybe a fascinating character unto herself, and the same is definitely true of her love interest, who is a beautiful hunk, Henry Golding, and is pretty much like a non-entity. He's very sweet. He has a role to play in all this, but I think so much of why the movie worked for me anyway comes down to Michelle Yeoh's character. I mean, she is firmly making the case for herself here, a case that she's made many times before as one of our great actors. I think that her physicality has often sort of obscured her acting talent in a way, at least for people. Like, people don't recognize the ability to emote that she has and convey characters because the martial arts work she's done is so spellbinding. But if you go back and look at something like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the expressiveness of that performance is off the charts. And it's often expressed through her physicality, but that's another thing altogether. But I think what the movie did was very, very smart in making her a little bit of a softer character from the very first scene where she buys the hotel up from under those racist people, the clerks. And she, in the book, she has them fired. In the movie, she just sort of admonishes them. And I think that lays the groundwork for a character who is definitely hard and has all the edge and represents all of the various familial forces that she needs to, but it's so, I think that tweak is so instrumental to making the last three scenes of this movie, the first of which starts on a Mahjong scene, which is not in the book as well, and has been written about at length online, and a lot of explainers that I'd highly encourage you to check out, and then the two scenes that follow, even the one that she's not in, her shadow is cast so heavily on it and is so powerful to it and is the emotional sort of bedrock of the big reveal at the end. And I think that the movie was very smart to focus it a little bit around her character and change character, and she did a brilliant job of leading into it, and I was very, very emotional by the end of it all. Right?
Yeah. No, I think way I convinced Java to eventually see this movie is that I'm like, it's a romantic comedy, and it's, you know, got all this, you know, rich cultural backdrop, but at the end it like becomes a movie about mothers, and I really appreciate that choice, and I think the movie is much better for it.
Yeah, I also. I've seen a few articles that were writing about the movie as wealth porn, and that's obviously what it is unabashedly being. And you know, articles about how the movie doesn't really get at it. It's so locked into one financial strata of people who live in Singapore. And I don't think that's a knock against the movie because it's
you mean like every movie that's ever been set in New York?
Right. Yeah. But it's also
or at least
like,
every romantic comedy.
It's this, you know, people are also like, oh, you know, it doesn't represent everybody's Asian or Asian American experience. And it's like, well, I mean, it's the same thing. It's like the movie has a very particular goal in mind. It is not meant to do all things to all people. But at the same time, I saw a film earlier this week that was at Locarno Film Festival. I watched over on a link, that is about land reclamation in Singapore and about how the island of Singapore has physically grown 22% since 1965 because they have cheap migrant labor that is allowing them in like the huge land barons of this area to import sand from other countries and physically build out the island. The population's doubled there, and the UBS buildings and all this stuff are on sort of man-made sand reefs. And there were shots in this movie, the wide shots of Singapore, where you could see these giant like dinosaur-like cranes in the background. And this other movie I was watching, which is called A Land Imagined, were essentially gave those same shots, but from the other side of the island, where, at least for the context of this movie, all of the impoverished sort of migrant laborers who were living in squalor live. And it was a very high... I mean, they're worth seeing in quick succession, if only because it gives you a more rounded understanding of the wealth disparity in Singapore, and which I believe is the greatest, if not in the world, and certainly in Asia. It's fascinating. It does not at all detract from my enthusiasm for Crazy Rich Asians, which I enjoyed wholly. I thought it was smartly written. A lot of funny supporting characters. The last three scenes are fucking Yahtzee of great ways to close a romantic comedy, and I can't wait to see the next one. Tonight's segment three, we are talking about MoviePass 2011 to 2018. MoviePass.
It's been around since 2011. Who knew?
MoviePass was founded in 2011. It did not really enter the public consciousness until much later, when and then really, you know, it skyrocketed last year when it switched over to their $9.99 all you can screen buffet unsustainable economic model.
That was like last year.
Yeah, it was last summer.
It was pretty recently that it became such a big thing. Okay.
Yeah, it was last summer. So MoviePass has been, it was technically founded in 2011. I don't know exactly when the app got off the ground. And I think for a while it was more for a rewards program, and then evolved into its latest, most exciting, and last, well, not quite last, iteration last year. But MoviePass, while you may still all have it on your phones, and maybe it will make a few movies available to you right now and over the next couple of months, is for all intents and purposes dead. It's at least in hospice, or maybe undead, if you prefer to think of it that way. It's still shambling along without a brain, constantly, every couple of days, it feels like rejiggering their policies. You can see three movies a month.
Literally every few days. Yeah. It's been hilarious.
But you should, when I say it's dead, I really mean that now would be a great time to, well, you can't cancel your membership because they may not let you, but it would certainly be a good time to abandon all hope on it being something that you can rely on to see movies going forward. Maybe once in a blue moon, it'll give you a good deal. But the movie pass that you probably bought into, if you did buy into movie pass, is gone. And we just wanted to hash that out. I am more interested in it. I mean, I guess I'm more interested in it in a philosophical sense, and what lessons it may have taught us about the future of movies. So maybe I can start there and then open it up to you guys to sort of carry the conversation where it may go. But my big takeaway from this whole thing, if I can boil it down to something, was that MoviePass was born out of the really crazy idea that two people had in 2011, that people actually like going to the movies. Which sounds insane, I know, but the prevailing wisdom in Hollywood in recent years, and certainly back then, which is the same year that Netflix started buying original programming, it felt like the industry was at sort of an inflection point, was that theaters were a necessary evil, and we were all sort of weaning away from them and going towards streaming, and that they were the thing of the past and so on. Even though movies have withstood essentially what's happening with the internet before several times and have been dying since the day they were born, and the internet presents a few unique challenges for sure, but there's a lot of Chicken Little thinking, and it really seemed like a radical idea that people would actually want to go to the movies if only they were a little bit more affordable. You don't want to have to mortgage or take out a second mortgage on your home to go see Horrible Bosses. Like, that's just not a really good and sustainable way of doing things. And then when you add riskier fare into the mix, it's really not going to incentivize people to go take chances on independent films and foreign films and all the things that are struggling at the box office anyway. But MoviePass died because it turns out that people like going to the movies a lot, especially if they can afford to, if they're doing it on a subscription basis, if their movie ticket is being heavily subsidized by a magical internet fairy that is going to allow them
to see. Bunch of investors who somehow thought this was a viable business model. Exactly. That's how it worked, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, we don't need to get into the mechanics of it all, but, like, essentially, someone else was, like, someone with this giant pool of money that may or may not actually existed was paying for every movie ticket you bought so that you could, on a $9.99 a month subscription fee, go and see as many movies as you wanted once a day. And it was taken at theaters large and small, chains and art houses and so on.
I mean, this just says, like, I feel like it says more about, like, my lack of understanding of investment than MoviePass, but I just, like, the idea that it was a business that would ever make money always seems so laughable to me, and now it's failing. So, everything, obviously.
It seems like a really good idea for a business. The problem is their model didn't include distribution, so they became a middleman, which that's what makes it impossible to make money. Like,
are you
AMC,
not counting Gotti?
I'm not counting Gotti, and that transition came way too late, which is why it was unsustainable. But that's why something like AMC is going to be able to work, because once you get them in and you have the distribution pipeline, you're going to make up the difference in, like, fucking concessions or something, or just in getting people to more regularly come to your theater, which I think has been
the overall benefit of the MoviePass system is now we're talking about people wanting to regularly go to the theater again in like a serious manner, and that's created a demand for the system to, you know, make it somewhat more affordable to go see movies or to have like a subscription plan for crazy cinephiles and not just, you know, cater to, you know, the one family that comes every 4 months but brings all their children, which yeah, I think what it was slowly bending to.
I'm not sure if distribution was going to be the magic bullet for MoviePass, although I agree with almost everything Dave just said. Otherwise, I think the thing about distribution that would have helped MoviePass is that, and one of the major takeaways from the MoviePass fiasco is the idea that the internet won't save you. I mean, the internet has no interest in sustaining and propping up old models, which, in at least for the purposes of this conversation, going to the movies is the cinema is. It's an analog experience. The internet just wants to disrupt and consume and ruin and move on, and MoviePass is looking out for itself first and foremost, and the movie theater is really just a means to an end. I think that the real takeaway from this is what we already learned, is that people love going to the movies. They want to be able to afford going to the movies because the movies had historically, before the prices started going up and up and up, been more affordable. And the fact that they can go to the movies more often will allow them to take chances on more things. It'll allow them to splurge more money on popcorn and shit, which is where the theaters really make their money, and so on, which is why it took until last year when... last year when MoviePass had this all-you-can-screen style, which revolutionized and ended their business, AMC immediately took notice, and in a very litigious and angry way. I mean, they threatened suing. They were like, this is unsustainable. They were afraid that that MoviePass was effectively going to hijack their viewers and have control over who can see what when, which was a very
real... They kind of did.
Yeah, and like they would
have... I mean, especially when they started messing with the model, being like, I'm only rolling to let you see like anything but Mission Impossible on your MoviePass.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, like, we saw that start to happen, and I think AMC's fears, which are well-founded, were a lot more intense and parasitic than that. And then AMC had the bright idea of taking their totally useless Stubs program, which is like, if you spend $8,000 at the movies, we'll give you like a free popcorn every once in a while. And they were like, why don't we, once MoviePass, we can see that starting to die. We have 1,000 screens in the United States alone. We're the largest chain in the country. Why don't we change our Stubs program to something called Stubs A-List and give people for $19.99 a month a sustainable, reliable way of seeing all the things they want that are playing at an AMC theater. And sometimes, depending on where you live, that might mean only your Mission Impossibles. But if you live in New York, for example, the AMC 25 in Midtown is screening, you know, the Chinese stuff that comes in. They're screening The Island right now, which is a well-go title.
Tons of Bollywood movies
Tons of Bollywood movies. I mean, they'll play the occasional art house, the top of the empire, as they call it, or used to anyway. And AMC can afford to do this because AMC, they've already seen in the past couple weeks alone, I think the 5 weeks since they operated, they began with this program, something like 174,000 people signed up for it. They've seen hundreds of thousands of movies, and by 2020, they project to have millions of users, and they can actually afford to have that many users. And the movie theater chain is only going to gain money in the long run because of the money of these customers bring in, and maybe their customers are going to start going to the movies more than they would when it was $20 per person for a ticket. And
so the assumption is that they can afford it just because of the money they make off concessions, like that, or what? Well, why yeah, is I mean, the AMC is
yes,
better position?
They have money coming in from different revenue streams, whereas MoviePass was only getting money from your subscription fee. So AMC, in addition to the subscription fees, which are $10 higher per person, is also getting regular ticket buyers plus where they make the real money in the concessions. So
And if you go see like two AMC matinees, that's already paid for your thing. And most people who use the subscription service, from what I understand, use it like 2 to 3 times per month. So already they're like the ability to regain that money in ticket sales for movies that they're already going to be showing, even if nobody goes and sees them. That's sort of like the difference, I think, is like they
yeah.
control the means of the tickets, which is why I think distribution would have been the only other way out for something like MoviePass, because like the idea is the same sort of thing that gave rise to the whole B movie industry. It's like, if there's going to be all these A movies out there and they're going to be dominating however your thing is, and all of a sudden theaters are like, well, we're not even going to air the A and B movies together. These are going to be separate things. You have all these other movies that's like, there's a very small group of people that are going out and buying a ticket for that. You want some sort of like theatrical spillover, and now that things are off in the internet, like all theatrical spillover is, why don't I just stream something, because it's just easier, you don't have to go out and do something. It would be interesting, like the AMC Stubs Plus is great because I think it, this is the model that's going to help theater going not go the way of, you know, like texting only screenings and what have you, but yeah. I am worried about the fact that it's so based around movie chains when it could be moved to the distribution level where it's like a consortium of studios. They would have the money to support these things. So then you go back to the model where the studio is paying into a company or a plan that, and their hope is that not only by giving away a few Mission Impossible Fallouts, they rise the rest of their slate. And that would be like the hope for this to progress and sort of like benefit the industry, I would hope. And it's so weird to me that MoviePass even managed to exist for as long as it did on that, on the specific way it operated, the all you could binge model, because there was like so many like Reddit threads or whatnot about like different ways to game this, where you go and you buy a thing, or you exchange a ticket, or you just go into like an absolutely different movie. And so like, it's going to be, it's interesting that, I guess, interesting in the sense that it didn't used to happen, but now it happens all the time on the internet, that it went from really interesting idea to gigantic business that had absolutely no way to sustain itself this quickly.
They grew way too much, way too quickly, and...
I think it did, you know, reorient a lot of the conversation back to saving the theatrical movie-going experience, which is going to be, like, a net benefit. It's just, yeah, it's amazing to me that anybody looked at the $9.99 business model and was like, yes, this will be worth... however this works out, this will be worth the net users we gain. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, but it does... I do think it's going to be a good thing in the long run, because movie theaters needed to recognize that the world has changed. I mean, that people do still want to go to the movies, very much so. And I think the fact that the content is so widely available anywhere, at home, on the move, wherever, only makes the experience of going to the theater a more rarefied one, and more that's like more of an event and more something that people actually want to do as an activity, in its own sort of backwards way. But we are also now living in a society where, from Spotify to Netflix to wherever the fuck, I mean, I'm sure there are other examples you could think of if you weren't exhausted at 11 o'clock on a Sunday night, that people want all-you-can-eat style things of doing things now. I mean, we live in a world where you don't have to pay a la carte for a lot of experiences. Obviously, going to, and like, we see this as more content. I think that it's not the same as like going to the opera, going to theater, or something like that. But I think that they need to respond to that idea, and that people, well, they want to be able to do this. And now that they can, I think that it's just a matter of other theaters taking that route, because AMC can't be the only one that does that. I think that you know, they're going to have to be ways, they're going to have to be subscription models for various theaters, depending on your neck of the woods. I think they're going to have to find a way to do this for rep theaters and for indie theaters. And I don't think that memberships are necessarily going to do the trick. I think that, like, getting a membership to the Metrograph is great, but what does it really get you? Getting a membership to the Draft House, I get, every time I spend, like, $4,000 there, I get free popcorn that I can't actually claim from my theater seat where I'm ordering my food. You have to, like, go downstairs to the information desk and wait online and so on. I think that, you know,
what if you bought memberships to studios?
I would not like that, and I don't think that's going to happen. I do not think that, unless we, I mean, there has been litigation recently in talking about revising old antitrust laws that go back to all the way 1940s and 50s, but between the studios and theaters, But I do not think that's the way to go. And it's only going to help Disney box everyone else out in the long run. So no thank you. But
I mean, we're all about to buy a subscription to Disney with the Disney streaming platform.
So. Yeah, we are all. Why would I buy that? I have no interest.
Also, again, they added wait until you have children. Everything will change.
They added a popular film Academy Award when the past 5 years that's been Star Wars or a Marvel movie.
We will be, like listen, Oscar. The popular film award will have its day on this podcast, but that is not today.
My theoretical question to you then is, is there a way for this model to benefit independent film?
Yes. I mean, I think that, of course, you know, in its current incarnation, it's up to the independent films that AMC actually programs, because if they're only programming Ant-Man and the Wasp, then it's no good to them, but I think that when, you know, this is going to drive the marketplace in a way that indie theaters are going to have to compete with to survive, and I think indie theaters might actually stand a chance of thriving with this model, because it's harder to get people to come out and see those things. I mean, this is our jobs, effectively. We are proselytizing for a lot of these smaller movies that, when they happen to be good anyway, that... then they don't have the name recognition of a Mission Impossible. They're not automatic buys. It's not like, oh, I saw that commercial during the Super Bowl and I'm going to go. These are things that are a little riskier, even for people that are, you know, more oriented towards that sort of fare. And when you can take the risk out of it a little bit, when it's just a matter of time and not a matter of spending $20 on a ticket in addition to whatever else, I think it's a great incentive to go take a risk and see something like Madeline's Madeline, which is a masterpiece that is not going to be for everybody. And if it's just up to, I'm speaking from a New Yorker's point of view anyway, your film forums and quad cinemas and Metrographs and whatnot to come up with ways of doing that. At the same time, well, maybe they don't have to. I mean, there may have to be chains. This may just be on a chain level because, as far as I can tell, the Metrograph, the Quad, they're doing, you know, gangbusters business as is. I don't know if they can fit more people through the doors. But it is something that, and maybe the hope is that it's so successful that the larger chains, if not AMC, then some of the larger but smaller than AMC chains will find a way of just playing more art house fare, because as long as they're playing enough movies, and they're going to need to play a greater number of movies in this case, quantity will become important. It will behoove them less to have 6 screens dedicated to Mission Impossible than it will to have 3 screens dedicated to Mission Impossible to accommodate demand, and also a screen for The Rider and a screen for Skate Kitchen, maybe. That's only 5. But you get the point. I think that in an idealistic world is an upside to this. But I do think, just to bring things full circle, philosophically, the lesson from this was that even in the internet age, when everyone is talking about streaming, that people show time and time again that they like going to the movies. They want to get out of their house. They want to escape their children. They want to leave their couches. They want to sit in a dark box where they don't have to think about Donald Trump for 2 hours. They want these things. And movie theaters can still provide them to them as long as, you know, they can afford to get it to find them. And then maybe if they can afford to go there, movie theaters will become more accessible and there will be more of them again instead of fewer in places like Compton, which we've talked about earlier this year in terms of A Wrinkle in Time. Maybe Ava DuVernay one day won't have to rent out a gymnasium and convert it into a movie theater to show the movie in her hometown. Maybe the movie theater will be able to come back there. I don't know. I'm trying to think of the best case scenario for this, but
I would say on the same day that I renewed my membership to the Denver Film Society so I could go to the film festival this year, I thought of a business model where somebody else buys your movie ticket for you by you selecting it on an app and essentially them freeing up like a credit card just seems like a system that could be used by any film forward organization to push something forward if you have the right investors. And then I realize I just became MoviePass. This is such an attractive business model.
Yeah, but you know, when the theaters are buying that movie ticket for you at their like from their own establishments, then it's a lot more like because the theaters are actively invested in their own survival, and it's not just about being a middleman. To go back to what you were saying about how MoviePass failed by not becoming more effective as a distributor, And they were a terrible distributor in their brief run in that game. I think that like the theaters looking out for their own interests will be for the good of movies in general. And maybe one day, and I don't want to distract from, you know, AMC, as good as the subs program might be, as much of a prudent decision as it is to invest in that in this way, it wouldn't hurt to, and maybe new revenue streams will help make this happen, to actually make being in their theaters a better experience by actually, I don't know, masking their fucking screens and not bombarding people with their insufferable ads. I mean, AMC is truly the worst. It's like the pre-roll stuff that they have is, it feels like being in a Walmart that you cannot escape and just is, it's terrible. And then they don't mask the screens. And so you feel, I mean, it's just awful. And the volume is too low. Whatever. Fuck you, AMC. But this is smart. Good move.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week, hopefully all four of us. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm not Matt Patrick because he didn't show up tonight. That means I go first in this part. I'm David. You can find me. I'm whatever. What do we introduce? Do we say what we do? I can't even remember anymore.
Where do you work?
It's David. Every time you're on a podcast, you should promote everything that you do.
I've heard that you when you're on other podcasts, sometimes it's a good idea to promote the podcast.
I have no idea to what you're referring, and I'm going to remain oblivious. I work at IndieWire. I'm on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, which I'm very proud of. My friends, Katie Pat and Dave. You can find all of us together on Fighting in the War Room. It's a podcast. But also, you can find our podcast, Fighting in the War Room, on Facebook, which is not a podcast, but is often an avenue to find a podcast.
All of our parents by you talking about what is in the podcast.
Fighting in the War Room on Facebook. What does Patches say? Does he do the iTunes store?
He does. FightingInTheWarRoom.com. It's a website where you can listen to our episodes and leave comments. The voice you're hearing right now is Dave. You can follow me on Twitter at DA7E. I also have a podcast called Storm of Spoilers. This week we're going to be talking about the modern rom-com, which was Crazy Rich Asians. But also, guys, do you realize there's been like a decrease in rom-coms released per year in like the past 6 or 7 years? Do we need to save it? Find out. Storm of Spoilers this week.
Now they're all on Netflix. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com, where I have another podcast called Little Gold Men, where David said our day to talk about the popular film Oscar will come. On Little Gold Men, it's been here for 2 weeks. We had a really long conversation about it in last week's episode with a lot of disagreement and some interesting hot takes, so you should listen to that. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And you can find all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about all kinds of things or just answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
Hands up, mutt butts. Sorry, I just wanted to say that joke again. What's the best on-screen puppet?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.